Welcome to the podcast dedicated to making you a faster cyclist. The Ask a Cycling Coach podcast presented by Trainer Road. And this is a special episode. We have with us Specialized Off-Roads, Matt Beers, who is currently the South African gravel and marathon mountain bike champion, three-time Cape Epic champion. I'm sure you've all heard of him. He's racing the Lifetime Grand Prix this year. Matt, I've wanted to have you on the podcast for a really long time. I'm really stoked to have you on here. This is going to be great.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm a, you know, kind of avid listener. It's always what I use for my training, listening to you guys who you have on. So honored to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, stoked. So I first heard about you, man, and Matt, I want to clear this up. I want to get into your background. I feel like I actually heard about you because you used to race motocross. Wasn't that like your thing? And then somehow you got into mountain biking. And I feel like I might have heard Grant Langston or somebody else, these famous mountain or motocross riders from South Africa, mentioned that there was some mountain bike or some moto guy gone mountain biker down there, but I could be wrong. That's your background though, isn't it? How'd you get into mountain biking?
Yeah, that is my background. I'm not sure if they even know who I am. I mean, I know who they are. I looked up to them as a kid, so possibly they've heard through the grapevine. But yeah, I raced motocross for, geez, how long? Probably like 10 years, I think. I even came to the States, trained and raced at MTF, MULSAPS training facility.
Wow.
And yeah, I tried to do the whole Loretta Lynn's thing and got pretty close. But yeah, injuries, you know, it's the kind of injuries and motocross go hand in hand. And broke my foot real bad and then kind of started the cycling journey as rehab. But never thought, I just remember seeing the dudes in Lycra thinking there's no way I'll ever wear that. Like, now here I am.
That's awesome.
It's a funny story.
Matt, how tall are you? First of all, and if you don't mind sharing your weight too, so then people can get a point of reference, because this is where I want to get into. Most motocross riders aren't that tall. Most mountain bikers aren't that tall. I think you're quite tall. Are you not?
Yeah, I think I can do Imperial for you guys.
Nice.
There yeah. So like 6'4" and 179, 180 pounds. So
all right,
like on the big heavier side.
Yeah. And for sure. So what made you go from like, I'm doing this for rehab to like, were you good at it? And was it just good at the bike handling thing because of motocross, or what made you decide that you wanted to pursue mountain biking?
Yeah. So we did quite a lot of testing at MULSAPS. We obviously rode a lot, like road riding, just for that like kind of zone two endurance. Obviously the motocross bike is super high intensity, like, you know, it's VO2 max, you're averaging like close to 200 heart rates. So we kind of had to build that like base just on the road. It was nice and consistent. And I was always, you know, one of the strongest guys, if not the strongest. I was just rolling, like it was just easy for me. And they were like, Sky is so good at cycling. And then we did some, they obviously had like whole lab and VO2 max, you know, with the mask and all that. And yeah, it turned out that I could push out a lot of power, and they were like, dude, you should maybe look into this. Like, it seems like you have more talent here than on the motocross bike. And obviously you don't want to hear that, really.
Yeah.
But I was like, I mean, it's pretty similar. Like, I can at least kind of take what I've had from motocross, like technique wise, and kind of hand it over to the mountain bike. And as a kid, I was always, you know, riding bikes and just doing jumps and dumb stuff like you all do. So yeah. I knew the bicycle pretty well. And yeah, that was kind of my coach. He trained me in motocross. So I've been with him ever since. And he was a very good cyclist. Yeah. So,
wow.
He played a massive part. He was like, dude, I think for sure you have it. And let's try. Let's give it a go. So I've been with him ever since, like 15 years,
I think. That's amazing. Wow. I didn't know that. That's cool. So a crossover coach going from motocross to mountain biking, and look at your success like that you've had. It's just so impressive. Do you remember what any of the like the numbers from that first lab test that you took there?
I think it was definitely above 400, maybe like 420.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So it was like
FTP.
Off the bat, it was pretty high. Like,
yeah, that's very high. Yeah.
Yeah. So I remember it was in the 400s. I can't exactly, I think it was like 420 or so.
Was your weight around the same then, or did you weigh more because of motocross?
No, I've pretty much stayed the same, funny enough. Like,
wow.
Maybe I was even skinnier back then just because your legs weren't as big. Maybe I was like a pound or two lighter, but that was about it. Yeah.
Wow.
So,
and then I guess when you got from going, like getting into mountain biking and doing all this stuff, how long did it take you until you got to the national level and having success from coming from, and for those that don't know, when Matt mentioned Loretta Lynn's, that's like the national level of, that's like national level mountain or motocross for amateurs, for non-professionals. And if you do well there, and you're at like the A class level, which would be effectively like Cat 1, then at that point, that really opens up doors for you to race professionally for different teams and all that stuff. So Matt was pushing up to that level.
Yeah, so I was trying to qualify for the B class and open school. Yeah, something. Yeah.
Which is tough, extremely tough to do. Really fast athletes and really hard to do. And so how long did it take you to find like national level success for mountain biking for you?
I think it was about a year and a half. Yeah, so this is quite a quick transition. Obviously, I messed up a lot, just nutrition wise was the biggest problem, I think, coming from the motocross. But yeah, about 2 years, I was doing pretty well already. So just kind of a year of like figuring out, like, how do we even do this? What works? And then yeah, the second year it started rolling pretty quick, and by the I think by the third year I was pretty competitive, and guys were like, who on earth is this guy? Because I had super long hair like down to here and I looked ridiculous.
How funny. So, and were you really good at, with that big of an FTP in that way? Because a lot of motocross guys are pretty small, and that's why they tend to be good at cycling when they start out. They have really good bike handling, then they just don't weigh much. They're typically 5'8" to 5'10", but they don't tend to be too tall really, and they tend to be pretty slight. That's where they do really well on climbs. Were you just realized, like, did at first, were you great on the flats? I mean, looking at your power to weight ratio, you're already over 5 watts per kilogram, which is just crazy. So you're probably really good on the climbs too. But did you find like that you had initial strengths, and then how'd you develop as the athlete that you are now?
Yeah, I think like the flats were obviously quite apparent that it was a lot easier for me just due to, yeah, being bigger and maybe the leverage, or I don't know. I think we just naturally, as taller guys, it's kind of easy just to push watts. And then I really like climbing just in general. I just enjoy going uphill. So I've kind of just always climbed a ton when training. Like I love trying to chase, you know, for us, I just love every ride, like either 1,000 is minimum and then like 2,000, 3,000. I just try and chase that number more than kilometers. I don't know why. This is an obsession. And that inherently made me a really good climber for my weight and for how big I am. I think I just developed like a technique, or just, it's just comfortable because I did it so much. And yeah, so that's kind of why I can climb pretty well for a big guy.
I feel like you have a good attitude about climbing too. And there's probably a lot of bigger athletes that might even have a good power to weight ratio, but they just, since they're bigger, they think that they're disadvantaged, or they, you know, they're out of their element.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's just, I enjoy it. It's just fun. I don't know why. It's just, maybe it's just the suffering. I do enjoy, I am a sucker for everything must be hard. And if it's not hard, it's not good enough. So maybe that's the case.
Yeah. Yeah. No doubt. You mentioned that you were making like mistakes with nutrition, that sort of thing. What are the biggest things that you've learned about yourself with nutrition as you become now this, you know, world-class mountain biker and gravel racer?
Funny, because I think on bike nutrition has probably been my biggest downfall my whole career, even not even like early on until maybe when did I win my first Epic 21?
21, up until, we were there. Yeah, I raced that one. Yeah.
Up until that Epic, I just couldn't figure it out. With, like, I would have really good races that were, like, phenomenal, and then I would just have absolute, you know, hitting the wall, like, gone. Like, I could be up there for 3 hours, and then it would just be a nuclear explosion. So that has actually taken me a really, really long time, and kind of, I think, stunted my progression in how well I could have done. But yeah, that's just life. It's just you learn along the way. And now that there's so much more info and guidance and everything, and it's also your own, you know, you have to be on it yourself. And I think a lot of kids and guys new to racing, you can get so stuck into the race and not really be aware of what you need to do. Like, before you know it, an hour and a half has gone by and then I haven't taken a gel or like one sip of my bottle. That was a typical thing of me. So
yeah.
So don't feel bad, anyone who does the same.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It takes like that diligent, focused, intentional work for sure. How much do you take? So like these days, do you know, some athletes don't track their FTP too closely, and you can give us a ballpark if you don't want to give away the exact number, but mm-hmm. where are you at roughly now in terms of FTP? Weight is similar, you said, around like that 81 kilo mark, somewhere around there.
Yeah. Yeah. So FTP is on Training Peaks, it's like 480, 485. Okay. So that's where it sits. So yeah, it's pretty decent, I guess.
Basically 6 watts per kilogram for those that are wondering there. So now I'm going to look something up here while we do this, because I have this like kilojoule thing that I always keep in reference, because to your point, I feel like a lot of the time we forget about how much energy we are consuming when we're riding along. And for you, if you're riding at your FTP, Matt, and you rode at your FTP for an hour, that would be around 1,750 calories for an hour. So for you, if you're riding zone two, like the base of zone two, so around like 55% of your FTP, you're still burning somewhere around 800 calories an hour. And that would be like fingers in the nose, dead easy. So like for you,
yeah,
over 1,000 calories per hour on easy rides is going to be the norm. And then when you're racing, you've got to be burning anywhere from 15 up to like, you know, somewhere around 1,500 calories an hour. How in the world? Because that had to have made the feeding thing even tougher. For an athlete with a smaller FTP, they aren't burning as much. It's not as crucial perhaps to replace quite as much. I don't know. But how do you fuel? That's like almost a downside of having such a huge FTP.
Yeah, I think, like you said, I think that was something I didn't really understand, just being so much bigger and burning so much more fuel. I kind of have to, and then obviously you have to train your gut in order to fuel at like 120, 130 per hour. But even so, like that's a lot, especially mountain biking where you having to focus, you're hitting trails like every couple minutes. It's so difficult to actually fuel that high. So yeah, I think what changed a lot the last 2 years was Mike Postumus, who coaches the factory team, the specialized factory team. He does nutrition periodization, like to my Training Peaks and stuff. And I think that's really helped me just being way more dialed, like leading up to races in training, you know, like going really high on days that need to be high. And so that kind of like made up for the, I think what I was missing kind of, because obviously for me, my biggest problem was trying to stay as light as possible because I'm big. It's easy like to put on weight, like you won't see it on me, but I can put on 3 pounds overnight just because there's so much more frame. And I mean, you don't, it sucks when you have to haul that uphill already. I'm a big unit, so it sucks even more. And yeah, we found a really good place with that, and yeah, that's definitely helped me be lean as well. Like this epic, I think I was the leanest I've been for a while, but also we didn't compromise on the power. But yeah, fueling, it's definitely, you know, I think each epic stage was average of like 360 watts, like 430, 420 normalized for like four hours.
Or I guess the stages are probably a bit longer, closer to 4 hours.
Yeah, they're actually shorter this year, like call it 345 to four. Yeah. So it's, yeah, you're burning at a big rate.
So. Huge rate. Holy cow. Yeah. I mean, looking at that, around 360, I'm just going to reference that chart that I have again.
Yeah.
So you're roughly burning somewhere around 1300 calories an hour. And if you're doing 120 grams of carbs per hour, granted, you're not just burning carbs, you're burning more than that. But if you're doing that, then you're just replacing about 500 calories an hour. So it's like an hourglass in the sense that, you know, your energy reserves are draining, whereas an athlete with a lower FTP, they won't drain as fast because they can replenish a bit more. Have you ever, we have Mateo Jorgensen on the podcast who talked about taking in 160 grams of carbs an hour. There's rumors of some top pro triathletes doing 180 to 200 now. And it sounds like they really pack it in on the bike. And then that way they can take in a little bit less when they're running and that's messing up the gut. But have you found that you perhaps uniquely compared to a smaller rider with a smaller FTP that you maybe run out of energy faster toward the end of the races? Because when I'm recalling things, seeing you at the end of Cape Epic stages, I would actually say the opposite. Like you always do really, really well toward the end of these really big days. So, but do you find that you kind of have this, the hourglass runs out a bit faster for you, or it hasn't been an issue?
It definitely can. I think maybe what I've kind of put it down to is if I do miss, there's a big problem. Like it's like, I think maybe from years of just not eating and I don't know, this is completely, I don't know if it's true or not, but years of kind of like, obviously I grew up or I started racing in that era where you kind of starved yourself, like low carb, a lot of fasted rides, a lot of like, how long can I go without eating? It's kind of like the, true. It's like, I was kind of in that when I was starting out, I was in that era. And I have a feeling that kind of did help like in my endurance, just like my body kind of knows how to deal with it. Like I said, this all could be absolute garbage. I don't know, but I feel like there's something to it. Like many years of that, your body kind of just knows how to deal with kind of running low on fuel. But yeah, I think the biggest problem is if I do miss, like, let's say I didn't fuel the first like 2 hours, it bites me really hard at the back end just because of that high rate of, you know, energy that I'm putting out. But yeah, I mean, it actually took me a really long time to just get to like 100 grams per hour. Like my gut would just seize up like past 80. And so geez, 160, 180. I mean, I don't even know how you even get to that. I mean, it takes practice, but that's insane.
Yeah. It's really an interesting concept for athletes like you that are like pushing the limits of like the high power range and sustaining that, not for short periods of time, not like a track racer or somebody, but I mean, going out and doing epic stages, big gravel races, you're going to be doing Unbound this year. And, you know, those are really big days. So it's just fascinating to see such a high output athlete doing well in these circumstances and stuff. It's just super cool. Have you ever gotten your sweat rate tested and everything else? Because I want to get into what you typically take in terms of, you typically take in a gel and drink mixed to whatever and what you do for sodium. So have you ever gotten your sweat rate tested? Because bigger athletes also have bigger surface area, thus potentially more fluid loss. That's a theory that exists. I'm not sure if that's actually scientific. It's just postulated by many and it's bro science. It's very logical, but perhaps not actually scientific. Have you had that tested to see how much fluid you lose and then how much sodium?
I haven't actually. Due to like the research, and it's like, okay, well, if you eat a lot of salt, you're gonna be a salty sweater, but if you don't, it's kind of a there's a lot of like conflicting kind of evidence from my camp that the guys that I, it's not really, they kind of like not, but yeah, I think it would be interesting to do in any case, maybe. But I think it's, you can kind of tell anyway, like based off of just your, how thirsty you are, yeah. to be honest. and like, you can see if you've traveled and you haven't eaten too well, you, your jersey becomes like, and your bibs become white. Yeah. Like for me, especially in the US, like if I do a big training ride after flying, like I'm completely white, but then, you know, after that, it kind of balances out. So yeah, maybe it's a good idea to get done, but I kind of understand how it works. But yeah, it's always good to know anyway, I think.
Yeah. How much do you, so what do you fuel with? How do you get in? Let's start with sodium and then we can go to, and like the amount of liquid that you aim to consume in an hour, and then we can go into carbs.
Cool. So I'm sponsored by a South African brand called Cadence. And the bottle typically is around, I mean, you can kind of top it up, you know, but it's around 40 to 60 grams in a bottle, and that has around 500 milligrams of sodium.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, 500 to 600, depending on how, you know, how, if you want to do double scoop, then it's going to be closer per serving. It's around 380 per serving of 40. So obviously if you bump that up, you're going to get quite a lot of sodium. So yeah, that's my drink mix. I typically run per hour about 500, or like an hour and a half is 750. Obviously on the mountain bike, you have to kind of be a little bit conservative. It's not like the road where you can just pound bottles and just go back to the car and get them. So I think we run a little bit like camels out there, to be honest.
Yeah, for sure. It's like you guys like have to just inherently be good at driving yourself right down to the limit.
Yeah, exactly. So it's tricky, but like once you know, okay, my body can handle that, then it's fine. So,
and then I assume you're taking in a gel per hour or something, or maybe multiple gels per hour. What are you supplementing that 60 grams of carbs with? How are you taking it in?
Yeah, two gels per hour that are 30 grams. So that gets you to around that, you know, that number that you want
to
get to.
That's a lot to carry and to do when you're racing something like Epic or something else. That's just, there's so much going on.
Exactly. So you have to rely a lot on, you know, at the feed zones to have gels strapped to bottles. And then like if you miss, you know, if you hit drop that bottle, you're actually probably better off stopping and grabbing it than just leaving it, because let's say like that 20 seconds that you lose there, I mean, you could lose like 2 minutes at the end. So that's always my thought process, is like if I miss a bottle, just stop and get it. Like don't even, it's going to cost you what, 30 seconds max. And then, but if you don't have that, you, I mean, it could cost you, like I said, 5 minutes at the end of a stage or in these big gravel races.
That's such a good thing to hear from a professional, because a lot of us amateurs are like, if you miss the bottle, we just got to keep going. I'm super guilty of this. In reality, I should just stop and take the bottle. Like it doesn't turn around, pick it up, and then you can go from there. And it would be so much faster in the end, because dehydration or running out of carbohydrate or not having enough fluid, those three things will all cost minutes, not seconds, you know?
Yeah. That's always been my logic, kind of. So, I mean, people have seen it and they're like, what on earth are you doing? Like stopping to get a bottle. I'm like, dude, I'd rather stop now than hit the wall at 100K and just die.
Well, back to that point we were talking about earlier, if most people have, you know, a normal size drain where all their resources are going out, that's where their energy is going. You've got like you've got a drain pipe. It's a huge one, you know, that you've got, that's letting all those resources come out. So let's talk a little bit about Cape Epic. You've won it 3 times now in 2021, and then you won this year, and then I believe you won in 2022. Is that correct? Yeah. So with those race wins that you've had, how many times did you do Epic before you won it?
Well, I did My first epic was 2016, and I did everyone until 21. So,
wow.
Yeah, I had about, what was that, five, four under my belt?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was the difference once you when you won it? I mean, I know that you were riding for Specialized Factory Racing, and you had a heck of a teammate as well coming into that one. But what was the difference maker that brought you from participant to winner?
I think kind of goes back to, so in 2019, I was starting to get a lot better. Like just figure, I got picked up by like a local team called NAD. And that's when I went on to Specialized Bikes. And Nico Bell, who ran that team, he was a really good racer in South Africa, and he just gave us like crazy support. You know, we had so many bikes. We had just anything we needed. Everything was dialed. And he really set us up to just, you know, how things are done properly and his guidance. And then I was on that team until 2019. And then I went to, I came fifth at Epic with Alan Hathley. And we won the African jersey, and we were kind of at the front in 2019. Like we were knocking on the door. We almost won the prologue against Nino and Lars. And then I kind of knew, okay, like we definitely, it's possible to do well. And that year I went to Stagiaire for UAE Team Emirates.
Oh, cool.
The end of 2019. So I did a bunch of tours there. I did Tour Burgos, Tour Slovakia, a couple like not classics. They are classics, but not like the classics at the end of the year. That I think that was just a huge eye opener as to just how gnarly these dudes are and how much they train. Like the level. Like you're obviously in this bubble back home and you kind of know like more or less, but then being with these guys, like around them, and then I was staying in Girona and just they were like, oh yeah, we're just gonna ride like 6-7 hours. I was like, dude, what on earth are you talking about? Like I've ridden like five and I'm like on the limit there. And yeah, that kind of just seeing that firsthand like really switched in my mind, like, okay, well, that's why we're not that good. We just don't train enough, or not necessarily training enough, just how like monk-like they were. Like, you know, everything's eating on the bike. I was like, how much like stuff do you eat, mate? Like for this, like a 3-hour ride, it was just like, I don't know, like 3-4 gels, bottles, drink. I was like, dude, I have like one bottle and a bar, maybe. Like I might have the bar, maybe not. And that was also like, I was like, okay, so this is how these guys do it. And I kind of learned from that. Stagiaire is a weird thing. It's not really a guaranteed ride unless you like do really well. I ended that, came back to South Africa. The team that I left, they took me back. And from there, that's when I just started winning a lot more. And I think lockdown also helped. I just spent every week for, I don't know how long it was, 20 hours on the indoor trainer. So,
wow.
Yeah. Like I went all in, just double sessions every day or every second day. And just trying to do as much as you can for like 6 maybe 4 months or something. I think that honestly carried me through for like the years, or like for that epic that next year, or just all that kind of figuring out, and then just that training on the trainer. I know how well it helps, and like with injuries, and it sucks, but I think it makes you so freaking strong.
Sure.
Yeah, that's kind of and then having the opportunity from Specialized, I think sometimes you just need that opportunity to kind of show. And I was lucky enough to get that.
Yeah. You, there's so much I want to get into here. I'm going to go through them really quick and then we'll get back to Cape Epic here. First of all, you mentioned the fact of for stagiaireing for, and I'm probably saying that wrong, but that's the word, at least for us Americans over here. You were riding for UAE. Have there been a lot of offers from the roadside? Because from the roadside, you look at like your huge FTP and everything else and all the things that you've done, you'd think, man, I really want to get Matt on a TT bike and I want to see what that guy can do. Or I want to get him at the front pulling for our team for 4 to 5 hours before we end up, you know, launching our climber up the climb. Has that been something, is that a personal curiosity of yours or have teams approached you for that?
I mean, I was kind of used for that at UAE and I did what I was told and they were happy with how I did everything. And, yeah, that definitely, I was used for that, you know, just towing at Burgos, Rui Costa and a bunch of those guys into the bottom of the climbs and things like that. And yeah, TT, I did TT Champs in 21, came second. I think I had 2 days on the bike. Yeah.
Holy cow.
Yeah. Ryan Gibbons, he beat me. But yeah, it was,
that's impressive.
Yeah. So like I've dipped my toe and figured it out, but, I think the biggest problem on the road was for me, like positioning and just not racing on the road. It like coming from little mountain bike races and local, you know, like provincial races and then getting thrown into like mini world tour with these guys that you've like watched on TV. I did struggle a lot with the positioning and as I got a lot better at the end, but I think that was a big, like, you know, and also my age, like truthfully, I was, how old was I? Damn, I'm 30 now. So yeah, I was like high 20s. And then you have guys, you know, who are 20, 21. Remco was just coming on the scene when I was there and I think he was 19 or 18. And
yeah, it's crazy.
You know, they're not really going to bother trying to like get this old dude to like figure out how to race in Europe. We'd rather get a young kid who, you know, who's been racing in Belgium for 10 years and he's 20.
So, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's just hard work. So, I mean, I was bummed at the time, but you understand all the circumstances and it's a big business out there. Like it is a pure job when you're on the road. Like it's not like here, mountain biking and gravel is just fun. Yeah. There it is, like it is intense. Like if you don't do your job, you get freaking eaten at the end. So yeah. Very different.
Yeah, I can imagine. Huh? You mentioned indoor training and like how much strength you felt like that gave you. What do you feel like benefits? Like what benefits do you unique benefits do you get from riding indoors? And I guess physical and maybe psychological, there's something to that too, maybe?
Yeah, I think I can name three big ones. It's the constant pedaling, like a 3 hour ride on there. I mean, if you had to look at your like pedaling analytics, 3 hours is 3 hours solid pedaling, whereas 3 hours outside is, you know, it's you going downhill, stoplights. So the efficiency and the pedaling, the heat acclimation is massive. Like that is huge. Like for, doesn't matter if it's cool, you know, altitude, it kind of just, you know, you build that like blood volume from the heat. And then, yeah, just the mental. Like, I mean, if you can sit on that bad boy for 3-4 hours, like you have a upper hand on everyone else, I think. Like it's definitely, it's mind numbing, but you know, it kind of does help. I think the only downside is that you just need to keep your technical skills up. But other than that, there's no real downsides to it, to be honest.
Yeah. There's a lot of people listening to this right now that feel like validated that their lives don't allow them to go outside and to be able to train for whatever reason, whether it's scheduling, yeah, whether it's just the other dependencies in their life, you know, and it's stuff to do. So I bet they feel validated. I'm glad you mentioned that. The first, so in 2019, you raced with Jordan Saru. You guys won that epic. I was like, I was there and I remember looking at your times because I was racing and I was just absolutely mind blown by how fast you guys are going compared to where we were. So like we were at like the, not the first people in the A group, but like at the pointy end of the A group, you know? And
yeah,
and we were there. It was commonly that we would be like 25% slower than you guys, which is just like absolutely wild. I don't know how you guys do it, but you've raced epic with Jordan Saru, who's fairly tall for a cross country racer, you know, taller than somebody like Nino or somebody else. And then you've also raced it with Chris Blevins, who's also tall. And then this year you raced it with Howie. And Howard Grantz is not tall. I think that Howie is like 5'8", maybe shorter actually, 5'7". Yeah,
He rides a small bike, like it's tiny. So maybe he's like 5'6", I would say.
Yeah. So how is that different for you? Racing with somebody like Chris, who you can probably get a draft off Chris. But then with Howie, I'm not sure you ever felt a benefit of your draft. Like your bars might not even be getting a draft.
Yeah, so it was a big difference, you know, racing with Howie, and also to the fact of like having Jordan, who's a super punchy rider. Like he's extremely violent out of corners. It's, for me, it's 1,000+ every corner. It's just like bam, 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 upper climb. You know, upper climb, it's 600-700 watts. It's just full all the time. And then same for Chris. Chris is extremely explosive. And then, so I've kind of just, you know, had racing epic in my mind, just trying to, just out of every corner, it's just, you know, this like explosion, and then up, like any little like kick, it's just full gas. And then racing with Howard, that's not how he races. He's a lot more steady, a lot more carrying kind of momentum, building it up a little more, not like snapping so much. So that was a big change. That I, the first 2 days, I kind of made mistakes on just, you know, being too punchy, and then he would be off the wheel. Not like, not that he can't go, it's just that he knows that doing that is going to hurt him. So yeah, once we found our groove, it actually really worked well, just because I think the way he races is so much better for epic, just not burning those, like, well, for me personally, like Chris, obviously Chris and Jordan, because that's normal for them, it doesn't hurt them, but for me it hurts me a lot more. Because I'm not good at that. So I think that's where, like, we found a good balance on, you know, rolling it a little bit more. And then yeah, with Howie, obviously I was a dedicated man on the flat.
Yeah. Hold on, little Howie. Yeah.
Yeah, which I'm happy with. That's my strength. And then on the climbs, you know, I just pulled over and he went in front, and then I just try to stick his wheel on the climbs. Like he has a really good like feel for the right pace. Even like sometimes we would like slow down and just let them kind of get away, like maybe halfway up the climb, and then yeah, truth, at the end of the climb we're back on their wheel, because he has a really good sense of pacing for like those type of efforts. So yeah, it's really cool, you know, racing with all, getting a chance to race with all these athletes, and it's interesting to see how we all are so different.
Yeah, it's like it's really cool to see you have success with such like a different profile of athletes. You've won 3 epics now. Is there something that you've figured out that you feel like is, well, actually, I don't even know if I want to put you in a position to reveal secrets or something, but you really seem to do well toward the end of these races. Like you're like in a relay team or something. They call it the anchor, like the person that pulls through. And every year it seems like whether you've been behind or whether you've had a lead, toward the end of the race, you're really able to extend things and to solidify a lead, or to really like get into a position for it. Do you think you do anything unique to be able to perform better toward the end of those hard weeks compared to other people?
Well, I think my coach should be able to speak more on this, but I'm just like stage racing, I don't know what it is. Maybe it's just the way I train. I like to do a lot of hours, and like, I'm the type of guy that just likes to ride day in, day out, like, you know, 7-8 days straight, no rest. Like, I just enjoy that. And I think that has kind of, I've just kind of built a, like, in doing that, I've kind of like built this resistance to fatigue, just because I like to just keep the load really high and not have a rest day for multiple, you know, like 10 days at a time. And
wow.
I mean, that's what my coach has, that's how he trains me. And I think, yeah, it, to me, it's just kind of normal. Like, it's, you just get through it. Yeah, so I think that's probably, and also like, it's not that hard. Well, not, but if you look, if you break it down really simply for Epic to do well, if you can stay and never fall outside top five, you're going to be on the podium. If you can never go lower than fifth every stage for 8 days, you will be on the podium.
Like, because of just things happening otherwise, exactly, to other people.
Yeah. Like, so that's how I have it in my mind. It's just like, just every day, don't be lower than fifth, and we will be on the podium. And then if you win a few stages in there, a good chance that you could win also. So that's kind of how I've broken down simply. And it is, if you look back at all the, that pretty much is the equation, really. It's just,
it's interesting.
If you're never outside of that percent, it's pretty hard to, it's pretty hard to go backwards from there. You can only go forwards.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, that's how it works. Super cool. Matt, you're acing the Lifetime Grand Prix this year. You're the current gravel national champion. Do you feel like gravel is unique, or racing the Lifetime Grand Prix over here? You did some events last year. This year you're in for the Grand Prix, and you're committed to the long haul, to doing the whole thing here. Is it different racing in the Grand Prix, and do you feel like maybe it's more on the road racing side, or are there just, what, how is it different compared to what you're used to?
Yeah, I mean, this is, I think it's just such a cool opportunity. Like, this, nothing else like this. Yeah, to be a part of it. And I think, you know, it's something so unique. Yeah, there's nothing quite like it. So I think it's really cool. And I don't know how long it's going to be around for. You know, sponsors come and go. It's a lot of money. It's, so yeah, to, I think we can all be pretty lucky that something like this exists. For like this, such a niche, it is pretty much a niche little discipline in terms of mountain biking and gravel. It's becoming bigger, but like, yeah, so I'm pretty excited that it's carrying on and that I get to come back. And every year I learn the races, I understand, okay, cool, now I know how it is to race at 2,000-3,000 meters. It sucks, but we can get better.
This, you just raced Sea Otter. You had third. As I understand it, coming into it, you didn't have ideal preparation. You were sick coming into that thing. But that race is really different, I think, from what you get from the rest of the Grand Prix. Maybe Schwamigan is somewhat similar in the sense that, you know, you're on mountain bikes and it's punchy. But what was that race like? And I mean, third for a debut there for, and never having done that race. And it is a really unique style of race, and even trail, like the trail is pretty unique in a lot of ways. Like, that's a very good result. What did you learn from the race?
Yeah. So, I really wanted to do Seattle last year, but I had to do some races back home. And yeah, I think it's very similar to kind of one of the races back home that we do, like the terrain, the kind of how the race flows, like really high speed for a mountain bike, but also it's like, you know, death by a thousand cuts kind of thing. It's yeah, you don't realize, like, I think the two laps is like more than 2,500 meters. And I mean, if you ever ride out there, you're never climbing more than, I don't know, 3 minutes or four minutes, like steadily. So to get that amount of climbing it's like crazy. You don't really realize it. But yeah, I really enjoyed it. It suits my strengths, like a lot of momentum, a lot of carrying speed. Like it suits my type of power and my riding style. And yeah, now I'm stoked. I've done every race. Like I did Leadville in 22. It wasn't part of the Grand Prix, but I just did Leadville, and then Cerrado was the only one I hadn't done in the Grand Prix. So now I have a good taste and a good idea. Okay, I now know every race, and I now know which suit me the best. So
Is there one that you're looking forward to most?
probably Cerrado next year again.
Yeah.
But Schwammiggen is fun. Anything on the mountain bike, I dig.
Yeah.
The Rad I actually really enjoyed. That was a good race too. And then Unbound is just pretty unique, I think.
Yeah.
It's the only race I will miss this year is Tasche, which is the one I did the best in last year. But it's just the travel for me is just a little bit too much back and forth. So try to keep
Yeah.
that to a minimum this year.
Yeah. And that's an interesting one because you'd think that from the outside in, being just super long, steep, sustained climbs, that's going to benefit a Howie or somebody like that. But if you're over 6 watts per kilogram, it's kind of like you go to Disneyland and you see that you must be this high to ride that ride. You've far surpassed that. So like so as a result, you can do well at those ones too. Matt, I think that I'd be remiss if I didn't ask for all the tall folks that are listening to this and also just the gear focused people. What size bike do you ride? And then do you do anything unique for your bike with your height being so tall?
Yeah, so in South Africa we have a lot of tall guys, so I think it's we're a tall country. Yeah, I ride an extra large in everything, or a 61 in, on the road or gravel side. And I don't really know, not too much different. I think obviously on the mountain bike we have droppers now, which helps a lot. Theater, I didn't ride a dropper, but that was just because it's nothing's really technical. But I think just maybe running tire pressure is a little harder than most guys.
What do you typically run?
I don't run PSI, so it's a bit
Oh yeah, you'd be
tricky.
running in bar, right?
Yeah, it's like
Yeah.
1.6, 1.7 bar, so it's like 20, what did that be? 25, 26, I think.
Gonna do it. Yeah, somewhere around 23 to 26, somewhere around there, I
Yeah.
think. Yeah, which is higher. I mean, I know for a
Yeah.
lot of guys, the smaller guys are going to be running somewhere around 16 PSI, 17 PSI. So, a substantially lower amount than that.
Yeah, I know a lot of guys who are a lot heavier than me that run way lower than I do, and I'm just like, I'd rather run the tires a little bit harder and the suspension a little more plush. And I think that's kind of how you actually meant to do it, like in terms of bike performance. And yeah, and it's just that's what I found comfortable. And yeah, that's pretty much it. Don't slam the stem to the head tube. It's a good advice for a tall guy. Get a
So actually,
bike, but
what stem do you run in terms of length on your Epic? What do you run?
so it's we obviously on the Epic 8 now. I saw you got one.
I
Nice.
do. Just built it up. I love it. It's awesome.
So now with the bikes, top tubes getting longer and longer, I've gone from like, so when I won the Jordan, I was on a 120 stem on the Epic, the normal Epic, and now I'm down to 100 and maybe a 90 even. So yeah, it's changing a lot, and but yeah, it makes so much of a difference for handling and stuff to try and get yourself on shorter stems.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. I'm on a 100 mil negative 17, and I think that for the target race that I'll do this year, which will be the Downieville Classic, which
Yeah.
I've never done, always wanted to do. And on that one, I think I'm actually going to go to a 90 mil and not a negative 17, because I think
Yeah.
that it's like the bike handles much better in XC and like normal XCO environments with the 100 negative 17 for me. I should probably technically be on a large, but running that smaller chassis with the longer stem, it just feels a bit better for me. I can get more weight on that front tire and
yeah,
it stays a bit more planted. But when you get into like the gnarlier stuff that's steeper, I always find it interesting. Richie Rude, listener of the podcast, he's certainly listening right now. So shout out to Richie and good luck at EWS coming up in just a few weeks. But it's really interesting to see what they do in the sense that they'll run different, they'll run more spacers underneath their stem, and they'll run different, like even bar widths and different stem if the, based on the steepness of the terrain that they're on.
Okay.
And they'll even run like different spacers or different adjustments in travel, because that front back height is so important to them to be able to manage that effectively, to get to the bike to be able to behave. So I think there's a lot more flexibility and customizability in it than perhaps people assume, that it's just, if you're a pro, everything is slammed and that's just what you run.
So, yeah, I've raced some Enduros on my Epic, and then I just slap like a, you know, an 80 mil stem with like maybe two more spaces underneath or whatever I have left at the top. And yeah, it makes a big difference just for that confidence on really steep stuff and the cornering. You definitely have to get used to it, but like it helps just make the bike not feel like it's going over the bars here.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was going to be my last question for you, Matt, is you were a moto guy. You had crazy fitness. What made you pick XC over DH or Enduro? DH being downhill, by the way, for the people.
Yeah, that is actually a good question. I think just purely the injury, it's like I was like going from an injury prone sport, and I was like, it would kind of be counterintuitive to go into another sport that has like the same injury rate as motocross, which is downhill and EWF. So that was my biggest, it was kind of like, I need to get away from, you know, breaking bones, which I've still broken a ton doing XC anyway, but I think the, at least it's not every year, it's like every, you know, couple of years, like, but with downhill motocross, I know how it is. Every year you have an injury and you have a broken bone. Yeah. And I was just kind of over that. It hurts and it sucks to like mentally go through that process. And I love training. It's like my therapy. So when I have to sit somewhere and do nothing, I literally go mad. I cannot do it. I'm like addicted to exercise. So could be worse. It could be other substances. So that's all right.
Yeah. Yeah, no doubt. Well, this is awesome. Matt, thanks so much for doing this. I really want to connect like at some point. Justin Brayton and I have talked, the pro supercross racer, about teasing around doing Cape Epic together one day. It'd be really fun.
That'd be sick.
It'd be awesome to get in a ride with you and Justin, and that would just be rad. So if anybody's listening, or for all of you that are listening to this right now, if you appreciated this video, Matt taking out the time of his training schedule and everything else to do this, it'd be great if you went and followed him and his team. You can find him on Instagram, Matt Beers 55, I believe, on Instagram. And then you can also find his team at Specialized Off-Road Racing. That's the same team that Howie is on, the same team that Sophia is on. You can find them out there crushing it at the Lifetime Grand Prix and other events like that. And also just follow, you know, the sponsors that support Matt, like he was talking about Cadence for the nutrition side of things and Specialized and all the other ones. So go to his account. You can find that stuff. That's the sort of thing that really helps these athletes be able to deliver value for sponsors. And then it makes it so the sponsors see the value in Lifetime Grand Prix. And they keep giving athletes like Matt and others chances. So I appreciate this, Matt. This is awesome. Thanks a bunch, man.
Yeah, thank you.
We're going to be cheering for you. So
thank you. It was a great, great conversation. Hope everyone likes it.
Absolutely. Cool. We'll chat soon.
Sweet. Cheers.